Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, we have a very special guest with us all the way from Sydney, Australia, Edward Sollig. Edward brings a voice to Venus Rising that we haven't yet heard, the voice of a sperm donor. Edward works as a town planner for local government in Sydney, and part of his work is creating new neighborhood parks in established areas. He has successfully created a new park dedicated to each one of his offspring, and one day, he hopes to push them in a swing. Welcome to the show, Edward.
Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking out the time and managing the time zone changes and being here with us. This is an important voice that we haven't had on the show yet. Three seasons and we haven't had a sperm donor. We've had donor-conceived children. We've had mothers who've used sperm donors. But you bring a really important voice. So I really do appreciate you coming on the show.
A pleasure to be here.
So let's dive right in, shall we? What made you decide to become a sperm donor? Let's kind of start back from the beginning. How did you find out about it and what drew you to it?
Well, I grew up in an era of IVF conception. So it wasn't necessarily new science when I was a teenager, but I certainly can remember stories about donor-conceived children. And there was a newspaper article a number of years later that I recall reading on a Sunday morning that when the laws changed in New South Wales, in Australia, of anonymity regarding donors, that the number of donors in the state dramatically decreased. And the figure that I remember is that there were three donors for that particular year. It was more for me in that moment an experience of the seed being planted. I remember noting that that news story, but had made no decisions. I'm also an only child. I'm a gay man. I love children, but I wasn't in a life situation where I would contemplate having my own children alone, and I wasn't in a relationship that was secure enough to sustain children within a coupling. When my father died in 2005, and I realized that I was the next and the last generation of the family line, that I started to contemplate being a donor. And I think that was the trigger, and it was the right time for me as well. So soon after, in late 2006, if I remember correctly, I started the process and I made inquiries and I went from there.
Okay. So it sounds like it stemmed a little bit too from wanting to have like a legacy, right? As a genetic offspring that was yours, and also helping someone else with their family.
Yes. But if truth be told, it extended further than that. My childhood wasn't optimal. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of energy in my life that ordinarily would have gone into a career or healthy relationships. But I spent a considerable amount of my own internal resources and energy in recreating myself, reconstructing myself. And there was opportunities lost in terms of my potential. And it was almost as if I was hoping to bring life to new hope and new opportunity for the next generation. I felt that I'd broken a curse in terms of patterns of behavior and mm-hmm. patterns of being that were not constructive, that were not nurturing, that were not enriching. And I was hoping that the next generation would have that opportunity, would have that chance, and they'd be able to meet their full potential. And this was an opportunity. So whether the generational lines ended with me was one thing, but my desire and hope for a new generation was also central to my thinking and to my feeling at the time.
You briefly touched on the laws in Australia, which we'll get to in a minute, kind of surrounding anonymity, which I don't really think that there can be in today's age because we have all these different platforms, 23andMe, and people are finding out. But we'll get to that in a moment. It seems like that didn't seem to bother. Like, you were okay with your biological children being able to eventually find you. Like, anonymity, it didn't matter to you whether or not they could find you. Is that right?
Correct. But I also think it's critical that outreach is available. I think in a process like this, I think that there has to be a generosity. Your decision needs to be well considered. And I knew there was going to be consequences. The consequences were the desire for contact or the desire not to have contact. So it's a two-way street. I would like to meet each and every one of the offspring that are born, but it's not guaranteed. And I knew that it always had to be their agenda. It always had to be their desire. It always had to be their want and their need. So from my perspective, the sperm donor very much sits on the outside, on the periphery. There is no direct experience. There is no baby photos. There are no childhood drawing. You know, it's very much a mystery of what happens and where the child is and what is happening to the child and if the child is okay. You know, there are times at Christmas or on a sunny summer's day that I think about, you know, what my children are doing. I know their sex, I know their age, what month and year they were born.
Okay.
So when you know the first day of school news stories come out, you know that there's a triggering in me of, you know, this is their special day. I imagine what type of day it'll be for them. So it's, again, you're on the periphery and their needs are paramount. You know, you're part of a process of creating new life, and that connection, that desire for connection when they turn 18 is paramount. And I wouldn't have participated in the process if they didn't have that opportunity or if that opportunity was closed to them. So I'm pleased that in the Australian context, it's no longer an option to have that anonymity, that they are able to make that contact. It's critical.
Yeah. So let's just jump there because we're talking about it already. I recently watched a documentary called Finding My Father, What Are the Rights of the Donor Conceived Child? And that featured Dr. Lauren Burns. And she yes. had created a previous documentary. And she was part of this legislation you're talking about of children being able to find their donors when they turn 18. Because before, it hadn't been that way. And they were struggling. The donor conceived population was struggling because they weren't even aware of some of their medical health, you know, history, right? And so in this film, there's a palpable nervousness that the legislation is going to change, that they're actually going to remove these rights of donor conceived people to find their biological roots. Do you think that that will happen? And it sounds like you're happy with the way the laws are now. Do you think that laws could change to benefit the donors and the children? Because ultimately those are the vulnerable. Those are people we should be protecting.
Yeah, my understanding from the proposed changes in Victoria in Australia, and I understand it was the first place in the world, Victoria, to regulate the industry. My understanding is the changes mean increasing the number of families that can be recipients and therefore offspring, and also making it easier to obtain a sperm donation from external countries without necessarily the rigor in place that any potential offspring could find their donors. And part of the problem also is that worries me is they may not necessarily have control over the age of the donor. So by the time the offspring turns 18, the donor may have passed. Now, I have a seventh offspring about to be born. And it does concern me that when the time for contact is there, I'll be in my 70s, early to mid 70s. I hope to be alive, but there's a real issue that if there isn't the controls and the checks in terms of allowing the contact, and if there's any anxiety that's developed in relation to how many offspring there could be, I think front and centre must be the consideration of not the industry and not even of people wanting to have children through the IVF process. It's about the rights of the offspring. And I think we really need to listen to those voices and those concerns. And if there's any doubt, you know, things should not be rushed. Things should absolutely be well considered.
Right. And the first group, and I feel like we're finally getting to hear from donor-conceived people. Like we're finally getting kids who are now adults to kind of talk about these matters and talk about their experience. So I agree. We definitely need to be listening to those voices. In Australia, from what I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and I know it's different, kind of like the United States, it's kind of like a patchwork of laws depending on where you are, but there's a limit, or supposedly there's a limit to how many children can be born from a donation. But I interviewed back in season two a lady who used a sperm donor to have her daughter, and she found out that her daughter has over 100 siblings, and that's really been hard on her, and you know, and their story. Her daughter's still a minor, so we won't go into that. But are you under that impression? Are those laws, is regulation being followed, or?
Given that the industry is regulated, private arrangements. But in terms of the industry, collection was that it was up to 5 families that could obtain the donation, and it's cut off there. So in my circumstance, there are 3 families. One family has an only child, a boy. The second family has a boy, girl. And the third family has a boy, girl. And I'm not sure where number 7 fits in, whether that's a new family or within that 3 family structure. But I think containing it to the number of families, in terms of also concern whether offspring meet and have a romantic connection by chance, the chance is there, the probability is there, stranger things have happened. I think keeping the number of families small is very important. Something else that I am hoping for and acknowledge is that through the 3 separate families in my situation, those offspring may or may not have a relationship. And for some of them, having that relationship with each other may be very important. So I can understand the anxiety of 100 offspring. It's not to say that all 100 will be active in your life or pursue you, but I think the opportunity for forming deeper connections among the offspring is also a critical opportunity or component of the unique situation of being a donor-conceived child. And it's almost, if not as equally important as their desire maybe to meet their donor. So, I think when we pursue donor conception from a central point of people as opposed to profit as the motive, I think we'll always do well.
Do you think that the age should be different then? Because it sounds like you have a strong desire to know about your offspring, which others might not. But do you think that children should be told earlier and that there should be a certain amount of transparency? And do you think the law should change to reflect maybe a kid in their teenage years who's really struggling with their identity, who they are and, you know, where they come from, instead of waiting until 18?
I think it's paramount. And this is where, you know, I have my perspective as a donor. Being a recipient and creating the family unit, you need to be very clear about what you're creating. You two are creating life and you're creating a person who has rights. And part of that, those rights is the truth. Nurture, nature are equally important. So what I bring to the table is my donation. And with that comes genetics. Behind me are pictures of my mother and my father. I'm very clearly more physically aligned to my father, but I have characteristics of my mother, which are quite strong. So within that child, there will be elements of behavior, of values, of physical appearance, which won't make sense in a family unit where the father is not the natural father. Mm-hmm. The love is there, the nurturing is there, you know, the care is there. In my situation, I have a strong feeling that the recipients are single women or lesbians. Because when it came to marital status, I said that I was not legally able to be married, rather than saying that I was single. And it was very, for the astute person, it didn't take much to work out, you know, what that meant. Sure. Now, the laws have since changed in Australia. But in my situation, should the offspring, and I think the probability is high that they have a mother or two mothers, I think that, you know, that desire is also very strong, and it won't be so ambiguous, you know, who is this my real dad, because dad won't exist in a physical form. But it is important. I think honesty is there. Children also have a sixth sense. I formed a relationship with a donor child in Florida, and at a very young age, he's quite astute. And at a very young age, I recall 12, he noticed that there were physical differences that didn't make sense between himself and the rest of the family. And sure enough, later in life, he found out that he was a donor conceived. Now, no matter who you are, that can bring a range of different responses, and there needs to be caution exercised. You know, what is the right age? I think at the stage where a child is able to understand, able to know, and not be confused about what's going on, I think it's a betrayal. I think it's a betrayal of the child's right to know. And also to give the opportunity of assurance, you know, that, you know, this daddy didn't make you, but this daddy loves you very much. And to even create the opening for, and one day you may meet your real daddy. Mm. Who knows? You know, he may be thinking of you. Mm-hmm. But what we know is that I think of you now, I love you now, and, you know, we wanted you, and that's why you're in the world. Mm. I don't think it's complicated. I think adults, unfortunately, make things complicated for children.
Okay. Well, let's get back to your story a little bit. I think I went on an aside because we were talking about it. It was important mm-hmm. stuff, but I do want to know more about your story. We kind of left off with how you decided to become a donor. And so do you mind telling our listeners what the process is like? You talk about knowing your offspring's age and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So how does one get that information? So kind of walk us through the process.
Okay, so the process is, in the Australian context, in my experience, and we're talking 2007, 2008, it was a year-long process. There was initial form filling. I don't recall any counselling sessions at the beginning of the process. What I do recall is, the donation process, and it's not one time that you're there. It's every 2 weeks, and there's a certain amount of volume that needs to be produced. So once you reach that that target, then you have a blood test, then you have another blood test in 6 months, and once everything is clear health-wise, I was offered, then you continue to fill in forms, and you meet with a counsellor. So my recollection was 45 minutes.
And that's after you've already donated, or did
already I? After donated.
Okay, yeah. Interesting timeline.
yes. You have this counselling session, and which is an important thing to note in terms of process. I believe I was interviewed by a doctor at the beginning of the process, but not by a counsellor. And I enjoyed that counselling session. And on the form, at the same time as this counselling session, the final form, there is a question. And the question is there a message that you want to give to your any potential offspring? And the words came to me very, very, very quickly. And they were short in number. It was give life, love life. It was give life, love life. The words have actually escaped me. Live life, love life, give life. That's what it was. And it was very clear. And I think really, it was, in a nutshell, what my motivation was, what my life philosophy was, and also what my hope was. If I have any hope for the offspring, it's that they are generous of heart. So then through the profile that you've just finished completing, it's a waiting game. And I was quite eager in terms of, you know, waiting for a live birth. Once a year, you're contacted by the clinic to make sure that your contact details are still correct, and you're also asked if there have been any health events. So there was a yearly trigger where you'd receive an email, but about every 3 months initially, I'd send an email keen to hear if there was, you know, any news of any pregnancy. And 5 years passed before I received news, and it happened to be on my birthday.
Oh.
Yeah, that I just sent this random email, and normally it takes maybe a couple of days to get a reply. So I was at work and I sent an email in the morning, and within an hour I'd received a reply with the news that there was a baby boy who was born in September of 2012. And I was elated. My heart just filled with joy. I can't begin to just describe the experience. Everybody in the office knew, and they were very, very happy for me. And but I will never forget that moment of joy, that the moment had arrived and that there was life out in the world. But little did I know that there had been a girl born in August, some month earlier. But it's up to the recipients to advise the clinic of the birth, and they had been delayed in advising of the birth. So initially I thought I had this son, and then soon after found out that there was also a daughter. So the two of them are very close in age. And then after that process, there was news of other births. And with the sixth birth, a girl, and I've named them all until I find out their real names, the sixth girl, Elizabeth, I anticipated her birth for some reason. Normally it's a guessing game, is it yes or is it no, but I sent this email and I knew she had been born. I wasn't given notice of a pregnancy, but I knew she'd been born, and sure enough, my feeling, you know, had been confirmed. So, you know, that's the process. About a year in the making, and from start to finish. In some occasions, I suppose it could be more efficient. It could be 9 months, and then it's a waiting game for news of a live birth. And with every live birth, you know, there is a very warm, joyful response that I feel within me, and I'm very grateful, very, very grateful.
So, but it doesn't sound like, I mean, for someone who wants to know, it sounds like the process to find out is a little like hit or miss, as far as like the family has to then tell the agency, and the agency may or may not send you a timely email. So.
Yeah, I always assume the responsibility of inquiring. And I think the vibe that I get from the emails that come back is that there's a lot of joy in the agency when they reveal the news, you know.
Sure.
No, I've always assumed the responsibility of asking, and they've been upfront. So the limitations are the sex of the child, the month of the birth, and the year.
Gotcha.
And the family structure. But it can be a little bit hit and miss. It's not necessarily an automatically generated piece of news that you receive.
Yeah. So I know that they have the registry, right, that kids can access at 18. But are you involved in any of the other, like, third party 23andMe? Because your offspring are still pretty young.
Yes.
But eventually, I mean, is that something that you would open the door to using those as well? Or
yes, I have. I have participated in one of the bigger ones, and Ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
But because I know that my donation is happening within a regulated industry in Australia, unless there's some offspring that have resulted from my father, for example, the chances that I'll be connecting with people directly related to me overseas zero. But also it's interesting to know just generally in terms of your genetic makeup, and what was very confirming was where my genetics comes from. And it's very much defined to a region of Europe, which is also important for offspring to know. Primarily, I come from the Istrian Peninsula in Croatia, which borders Italy, and was a crossroads from Europe and Asia. And my mother is Slovene on her paternal side, also from the border area of Italy. And when I have visited there as a child and as an adult, I very much feel connected to land and place. It's in me. I am Australian by birth. I'm born on Gadigal land, traditional owners of the land in part of Sydney where I was born. But I know I my origins are elsewhere. And I think for donor-conceived children, there will be a physicality that's different. Even though I was born in Australia, I get asked the question, where are you from? And I make reference to the name of the hospital that I was born, but I know what they're asking. You know, the DNA is on my face. It's in my skin. So I think donor-conceived children also have that intrigue about why do I look the way that I look? That may not necessarily be like their mother or their other siblings. Yeah, that's important too, you know. The generations that you're tied to, you know, the ones that are over my shoulder, the stories. I have a whole lot of series of framed photos from the 20s and 30s. Now, when I'm gone, they'll be of no value to anyone else in Australia, but I've had them framed and I've had them kept because I'm handing down the story, the generational story, potentially to the donor offspring. In terms of the process of donation in Australia, paid for incidental expenses. You know, it could be car park, it could be fuel, whatever the case may be. So I was given two checks of $200. Now, I never cashed those checks. But I've had those checks framed for the first two offspring that come to visit me. I want them to know that in terms of my motivations, this was an incidental offering in terms of expenses, but it was never about money. Mm. You know, it was about life. It was about opportunity. It was about identity. It was about living life, loving life, giving life. I want them to understand that was the motivation, that they matter, and most importantly, that they matter to me, whether they come to connect with me or not. You know, I wish them well, and I hope the best for them.
Yeah, that's very, very thoughtful and very considerate. I can't imagine that every sperm donor is as thoughtful as you are, but I would hope so. If there were people maybe listening, young men who are considering being a sperm donor, maybe outside of Australia, I'm in the United States, so very unregulated here. it's an interesting. I call them big fertility. I think that they don't really care so much about the people that are made rather than the profit. So it's very different. But would you have any words of wisdom or insight to anyone who might be considering this?
Yes. Find yourself a reputable agency. Be clear on your motivations. I think part of being a donor is the recognition that you take the back seat in the process. You're very much in the shadows. So, you know, be willing to be generous without necessarily, you know, something for you, but be aware of the consequences of what you're doing, that you are creating the opportunity for new life. And I very much, part of my personality is mentoring younger people. And I love it when younger people, particularly in the workplace, gravitate towards me. It's be prepared to be that mentor. Be prepared to be an additional life force. That's giving, that's nurturing. They will always be your children, you know, to death do you part. And there is a role. You won't be involved necessarily in the upbringing to adulthood, but you can certainly be an influence for the rest of their lives. And be prepared for love and be prepared to love. That's very important. You know, I'm looking forward to the embrace. I'm looking forward to holding them. I'm looking forward to seeing them. I'm looking forward to hearing them. I'm looking forward to understanding them and watching them change and grow. But again, it's their agenda. I hope for that opportunity. But should that opportunity not come for one or all of them, again, I come back to the point, you know, I've played my part and I wish them the best. And I think any donor needs to come from that perspective as well.
Yeah. And it sounds like you did your research. You had that relationship with the donor-conceived adult in Florida. Would you recommend that anyone, you know, kind of considering this, listen to those donor voices, donor-conceived voices?
Yes, I think it's important to be informed. I per se didn't do any research. I just went with the process. I knew what motivated me, but it was after, with the advent of YouTube, etc., that I had a desire to see what's out there in terms of donor conception. There's a lot of stuff out there which is, you know, personal stories, but there was a particular YouTube clip that involved the interview between two donor-conceived males that I happened to wake up to at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was an authenticity in the exchange. And in the story and in the journey. And that's how my connection with this donor-conceived man happened. I emailed him. But I think listening to stories, different types of stories, trying to get a broad overview of what the challenges, the struggles, the hopes, the aspirations are in donor-conceived children in the context of where you are. And using that also as an understanding about what you're thinking about doing and what you will do and how you will do it and how you will manage the consequences of what you are doing. It's vital. I think it's important to be part of the process, but we need the right people who are donating. We need the right people who are motivated to participate, and we need the right people who have the capacity to be there for offspring in the future. I went on an overseas trip in 2018, and I make no assumptions. I didn't know what was to happen to me, so I made sure that for each of the offspring I had written a letter and I'd enclosed a photograph of me, so they had something. And 2 years later I happened to have a mild heart attack, but had I not acted promptly and with instinct, I may not be here today. And the thought that an adult child, approaches the agency and then has nothing and not a photo, I think is cruel. So, you know, your consideration and the detail and being proactive and being sensitive, that's very much part of the process too. It is for me, and I would encourage other donors to think about that. You know, leave them with something, because you just never know what might happen over the years, from potential conception to upbringing, and what might happen to you.
Wow. You've said a lot in our interview, and we're kind of closing up here, but you've said a lot of things that you want your offspring to know. But I'd like to end with that. Is there anything additional? If they're listening several years from now, they're teenagers, they're going through podcasts, they found out their donor conceived, and they're really trying to find details of it, and they hear this, what would you want to say to them?
Simply that I love you and that I hope to see you. And you are extraordinary. And see you on the steps of the Opera House.
Awesome. Well, it has been an absolute privilege to have you on the show. And Edward, I thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with me and to share a very personal, private story on Venus Rising for everyone who listens to hear. So thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal is, as ever, to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.